kept going down this road of what drives people to innovate and took me into this world of creativity. And this was fiddling in my brain about outdoors and walking and what does that do? I naturally ended up at this research place with all these papers on my desk of this stuff, which eventually ended up in the book.
Gary Pratt is my guest on this episode of Inside Ideas, brought to you by 1.5 Media, Innovators Magazine, and sponsored by the Alohas Regenerative Foundation. Gary is the co-founder of EarSwitch, an innovative sensor technology startup. He was previously entrepreneur in residence and a teaching fellow in the entrepreneurship at the University of Bath, where he ran an accelerator program that supported high-tech, high-growth digital startups in the areas such as media tech, AR, VR, and AI. Gary has held senior positions in the pre.com tech world across the US and Europe and is the co-founder of TeachIt, a leading educational digital content provider. The Creativity Factor, his book, which I'm holding up right now here, offers scientific and practical evidence for the entrepreneurial creativity with advice on the mechanism, habits, and techniques that develop the skills. This unique holistic guide will provide you with a newfound awareness of your creative potential and how it can lead to business success. And for all those in the United States listening to this podcast, January 24th is the U.S. book launch. So it's a global book, and it's exciting that a lot of people will have access to it now. It's important in these times since COVID and Brexit and all the things going on in the world in the publishing industry to have multiple publishers and distributors around the world, because with new laws and regulations, especially in the EU, it's been difficult to get books. But I'd like to welcome Gary to the podcast, and thank you for being here, Gary.
Thanks, Mark. I'm lovely to be here and to meet you and have a chat.
I'm excited to meet you. When I get books or publishing companies send me books of their authors or am approached at all to discuss different things, it's really important for me to read the book and go through and understand the principles. And honestly, I have to be very honest with you, the Creativity Factor, just here by judging the book from its title, I was intrigued, but I wanted to make sure I read it before. So I do a lot in innovation, creativity, education, and to speak with a lot of authors. And so I approached it with a very skeptical eye.
Good.
Not even probably 15 pages into it, you had me sold. I was hooked, and I read it in a day and enjoyed it thoroughly, and went back and reread it again to get some touch points on things that we could discuss here today, and also some really crossover connection points for your work, for the science behind it, for what you've come up and created in this work that I see a lot in a lot of my colleagues and other authors and people that I've dealt with over the years, and how that's emerging. So first, I want to start out asking you to set up this moment in time, what brought you to write this work. I know what it is, but those who haven't read the work don't know what it is, but it has to do with a little story as well. So I'd love for you to tell us that now, if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think before I do that, start maybe at the other end a little bit and then come back to that. Okay. I had a UK book launch last month. And I'm very flattered that a lot of people came to the book launch, even though England were playing football. So that was nice. But I gave my speech, and only a short speech of about 10, 15 minutes. And I finished it by saying none of the words I've said were my own. I gave a speech using all the quotes, or a lot of the quotes in my book. And I think that's pertinent, that I think the science in my book is all out there, and I was just bringing it together with to fit what I'd learned myself, really. I'm absolutely riding off the back of a lot of other science journalists, authors, and thinkers, which is probably always the best way, I suspect. But to your point, yeah, I tell a specific story in the book, but I guess it's the reality is it's there was a lot of those stories. But the one that I think you're mentioning is I'd actually, you mentioned Teachit in your introduction, which was a fantastic entrepreneurial journey for me and my wife. And we'd sold that, and which I guess is people think is a success. You exit a business, and I guess it is in a way, like a lot of exited founders, you then flounder around thinking, what's life now? But I went back to my roots, and I'd studied as an archaeologist my undergraduate years. I'd always tinkered around. I'd always got my trowel out each summer and done a bit of archaeology, but I went back and studied for a master's. And to put myself sort of out of my own comfort zone, I started signing up to speak at conferences and soon realized that was absolutely terrifying. From a business background, yeah, you talk at things, and I was found that quite confident doing that. And suddenly into a new world with really critical peers in the academic world, it was a terrifying thing. But one story was I was talking at one of these in Edinburgh in Scotland, and just happened in luck in hindsight that it was a very busy traffic day. I'd flown into Glasgow Airport and my taxi got stuck in traffic on the way to the conference, and I had almost no time until I was due to stand on stage. And normally I would have got there early, and probably like lots of people before a business meeting or speech, would find a quiet spot in a cafe or an internet cafe or a hotel lobby, keep reading their notes and trying to make it go in. And that was what you did. Suddenly I faced this, I'm not going to make it. So I just got out of the taxi and walked there. And almost, it sounds, but it was almost walked straight in the door, got my lanyard, walked into the lecture theatre, couple of hundred people in this lecture theatre, walked onto stage, plugged my USB in and had to give my speech because there was no time to go to the toilet or to look at my notes. And it was brilliant. It was the best speech I've ever done. There were some scary academics in the audience, which if I'd known they were there and spotted them before, would have sent a cold shiver down my spine. But it was definitely the best presentation I've given. And I got great feedback. And so it was, rest of the conference happened, socialized, heard other people's speeches. And it was only reflecting afterwards that I realized I was an idiot. And I'd always used walking for thinking. When I was running Teachit and before and throughout my whole life, I'd always thought, my brain's addled, what do? I'll go for a walk. But I'd never really put the two together and thought of it as a proper thing to do in business. So that was the beginning of it, really. And I'll let you ask me another question maybe, but really the next stage was I jump around. I got my master's in archaeology, and that was great. That was sort of a nice tick for myself. But actually, I then went back, and when I was at the University of Bath, or before my jobs at the University of Bath, I started a PhD in the School of Management. It was actually a PhD to do with Phoenician expansion into the Western Mediterranean, which is so Bronze Age business. But actually, it took me down a rabbit hole of two things. One, the rabbit hole of, which I guess quite happens when you're researching, kept going down this road of what drives people to innovate, and took me into this world of creativity. And this was fiddling in my brain about outdoors and walking, and what does that do? I naturally ended up at this research place with all these papers on my desk of this stuff, which eventually ended up in the book. Also totally put me off a PhD, which I realized writing a book was much better because you don't have to listen to those peers and write 80,000 words that no one's going to read. Hopefully it's 50,000 words that some people will read. So that was the sort of journey to start the process.
I love that. That's a fabulous story. And it's also what really connected and resonated. I work with nature and agriculture, environment, and I always say that it's hard, but that agriculture, farming, domesticated human beings. So before that time, we were hunters and gatherers, and we walked, and we were outside quite a bit. And then at the age of agriculture or farming, which is now looking back at upwards of 13,000 years or more. There are even some suggestions now through archaeology, which is also unique, that could be as well as 20,000 years ago to some respects. And in that process, yes, it took a lot of time, but then we became more sedentary. We spend a lot of time in the home and not as much time out there harvesting and turning the ground, and also our impact on climate change. But there's a reversal on that saying that I say it as, really, work has domesticated us to be imprisoned in these boxes today and sit behind these computers and look down and take not only a different form of ergonomics, but a huge domestication of trapping of human beings on the way we work. And it's like the more hours you spend behind the computer or confined in a conference room or in a building, the more productive or effective you are in some respects. And I would like to understand some of your thoughts and theories through your research and also in the book, how you feel about that trend as well. Do you also believe that work has really domesticated and trapped us into a kind of a failing system as far as what we're experiencing in our world and what's going on? And not just in tough times like COVID or Brexit or things come or lockdowns come that confine us, but also that this way that we've set up our world of work is a trapping in many ways, as far as you also in the book address ROI. And so I'd like to kind of see how you tie those together or what your thoughts are.
Yes. Oh, there's a lot to unpack there, Mark. I'll start with a quote that's in my book, which I've pretty much commandeered from John le Carré, which a desk is a dangerous place from which to view the world. And I think there's a lot packed in there. But you're right. I think that we're going to look back on this period. I say it in the book, and it's a quote from another person, actually, Michael. So we'll look back a bit like we currently or previously looked back at the Victorian workhouses and mills. And it's all the physiological side, all of our evolutionary side, all add up that this is not the place we do. We're not productive, we're not creative, and we're not well doing it. There's lots of bits in there that add up to that. But as you say, it's the trap that we've been told that is work. And I think one of the calls I'm trying to say in the book is that we're sat at a desk now, I'm sat at my desk. We're not going to get away from that and our computers as tools to do work. But deep work, and when I say deep work, I especially mean thinking creativity, thinking about innovation, whether that's for your business or yourself, I think they both happen. That doesn't generally happen at a desk. And I think we all absolutely know that. But we're trapped in the sort of classic work hard, play hard, you know, work time, me time. And I'm starting to think that it's all me time, yeah? Whether you're working or playing or with your family or doing other things which wouldn't be counted as work, I'd like to see a time when that's all accepted as part of work, if you like. I wanted the book to be accessible for business people, owners, venture builders to start to explore that, because to be a hard call to get companies to say everyone can be wherever they like, working outside, walking up a mountain, because there is productivity to be done, and you mentioned the ROI side of it. But I think if you focus that return on investment in those really deep bits of business, which are thinking about the future, imagining what the future is going to be like, your strategy, how you're going to innovate, how you want your staff to think creatively at all levels. That's not necessarily coming up with the best new product or service. It might be just how I do things, how I feel better in my job. All those things add to productivity. And in the book, I go into some of the, I guess, the accepted specifics, all the science that's coming out about the benefits of a four-day week and that not affecting productivity. People are more productive because they get time to spend on other things. I tell a story in the book about a senior Googler that I talked to many years ago about their 70-20-10 rule about how they spend their time, and the smaller percentage supposedly about thinking outside the box and innovating. And I think Eric Schmidt's idea was that would be people working in the office still and coming up with new ideas because they didn't have to do their to-do list. And John, who I spoke to, said, I said, what do you do with your time? He says, I just go home. And at the time, it seemed really strange to me. I thought, that's not what they expected. But actually, I think if he went home or walked through the park or went for a run or did something else, I think he was probably bringing more to the party than the people who felt they had to go to a room to be creative. Or so I've come full circle in that is work. I tried to put a lot of methodology in the book as well to frame that, but I've put that in because I do work outdoors with teams. And when you're having those conversations about what are we going to do for those 3 days in the wilderness, I can go through the science. There's plenty of science in the book about some great academic studies about how your creativity increases over time and about how those traditional methods of brainstorming don't work. So I can normally talk to companies about benefits of doing it, but then it's, what are we actually going to do? And then really I want to say is, let's just go for a walk and see what happens. But they want some structure, and that's totally acceptable. So I've built methods through my own practice and working with people that answer your point, I think, is where they then see the ROI. You know, what they, the feedback is generally clarity of thought, that all those ideas bouncing around, which are always there and people have them and they're on lists, it helps them properly process that as a group or individually. So that's a massive, that sort of clarity is, I think, one of the big things, and that leads directly into sort of business strategy. And I guess you asked the question, sort of, sometimes, why does that happen? And I think back to your point as to evolutionary history, there's a whole section on the book, I know you've read it, which is, we were actually, this is what we were designed to do. We are designed to be cognitively enhanced endurance athletes. We're designed to be outside, moving in nature, doing things, thinking on the fly. It's what we were designed to do. And your point that maybe the agricultural revolution suddenly started to close that door on that. And in the 20th century, slammed that door shut and said, stay inside your box and only go outside for your bit of exercise at the end of the day to de-stress. So hopefully I'm just trying to nudge that door open again. And
yeah, there, it's really interesting because there's a couple different camps or thoughts. There's a big camp that is talking about the future of work. And you mentioned a 4-day work week. There's Tim Ferriss who talks about a 4-hour work week and how do we get out and how do we be more effective with our time and be more productive and do that. And then there's another camp where it's, we need you to clock in and out when you get to work and when you get out of work, when you go on break, we need you to clock out. We need to manage every minute of time that you're here. Yes, we're thinking about productive ways that you can do your work. So what we've done is we've done an open office space with no cubicles, but everybody sits in this open, transparent space. But you have to go and check out your computer, or you're never guaranteed the same sitting place the same day. If you get here early before everybody else, maybe you can have the same place more than once a day if you do that. And there's these kind of very strict rules around freedom or openness or this future of work. And in the innovation space, in the technology space, we've really been talking about the future of work for a long time, but that's all we've done is we've talked about it and we've created some ping pong tables and lava lamps and some foosball tables and bean bags and stuff. But we really haven't truly prepared the infrastructure, the human resources and the policies for that true future to arrive and what that really looks like. In what you just said, there are three areas that I want to touch in because you've already at early in the stage of our podcast opened up not a can of worms, but three things where we can really go deep. And I want to touch on those. One of them is, I don't even know if I should bring it up, but I'm going to because I'm a troublemaker, I'm a rebel, is Brexit. So Brexit, specifically for the United Kingdom, you're in the United Kingdom, is the fact that they've created a system there where they're upset about jobs and there was a racial factor in there, migrant workers, food workers and things. It passed, it's changed now. Are we on the fourth prime minister or the fifth? I can't remember, it's so many. But what happened is it was really about taking jobs, about outside people coming in and working so often. What happened is two things, COVID and the pandemic and also the Brexit at the same time. And now those people were no longer there and nobody in the United Kingdom jumped into those jobs. And the infrastructure, the future of those, the way those jobs functioned, were filled in a specific way by specific people, wonderful people, but that's also an outdated model. And so I think there are some huge tumultuous things that we saw and experienced because we actually have jobs that are not so desirable, but yet we feel like it's a burden on society or something. And we make a rash decision like Brexit to change that. But then very few, I think it's even less than 1% of those who voted for Brexit jumped into those jobs that now were left empty to be filled. What is that telling us? And I don't want you to be too controversial, but I want to say, why do we see that? How does that happen? And what does that tell us about the future of work? Not just about being outside, but the way we've created that work.
Gosh, another big question. I guess that there's two things there, isn't there? Plenty more than that, but okay, I guess COVID more than Brexit fundamentally changed how people work. And that's definitely something people are starting to come to grips with. And you mentioned, you know, there's leaders and teams who want everything back to normal, please. And that brings in the issues of Brexit as well. So nothing is normal anymore, is it, in this country? But for the rest of the world as well, COVID's made most things not normal. So that's
and I want to caveat that I'm not just picking on you. It's not just the United Kingdom. There's different forms of Brexit and things going on all around the world. But I'm just because that's where you're at. And I think you've actually run into this. So I would love to hear more about it.
Yes. So the COVID side absolutely has changed the nature of work already. And I guess it's how is hopefully using that as a positive platform to question how we work. And I think there are lots of companies now doing that. And it absolutely brings pressures of leadership in the sense of trust, letting go. How do we communicate as a team? And I think most of us are fed up to some degree of this type of communication. And definitely I'm getting a lot more interest in teams wanting to use the outdoors as a place just to communicate. And there's lots of benefits in using that in terms of hierarchies breaking down and having different conversations and plenty of science around that. The Brexit point, I think, is fundamentally more worrying in a way, because I think a lot of companies will find their way to at least question how work happens because of COVID. And maybe that's a real positive. At least there's a big question mark. Is the way we did things right? Has what's happened ruined us? And for a lot of companies, it hasn't. And it's opened up new doors. So I think there's a lot of positive out of that side of things. The sort of jingoistic approach of COVID, I think, is a dangerous thing in a global market, full stop, isn't it? And probably not to talk about politics, guessing that my politics are, that's a bad thing. And I know it's not for everyone. How does that affect the future of work? Having conversations with different people. There's a story in my book about Adam Kahana, who very high level sort of facilitator who helped governments. One story in the book is about Ecuador. And helping disparate groups communicate and come together. Now, he uses the outdoors, it's why it's in the book, as walking and talking as a tool. But the fundamental bit there is that there's so much more to be gained from cross-cultural, cross-border work and communications. And a lot of us work for companies which are global. So it seems absolutely nuts in this modern world that there's this jingoistic political approach to shutting down borders as far as work is concerned. Not to go into details of the practical outcomes of that for the country in terms of work, but yeah, I don't want to say
The reason I bring it up, it wasn't political at all, but it's a telltale of our work infrastructures, our work, the way we work, set up to be in a lockdown situation, set up to be in a situation where sometimes even the borders are closed. And does that open up new job opportunities for locals? And are they willing to take those jobs? So has unemployment, now that all those jobs, I think it was between 400,000 migrant employees, workers a year, to clear up to 600,000 migrant workers a year to the United Kingdom for food jobs, for farming, agriculture, food processing, grocery stores, hospitality work. Were those jobs all filled? Is unemployment back down? And the way it ties to nature, walking and outdoors, is because I mentioned the fact migrant workers, they're not people born and raised in the United Kingdom. They are traveling from their home countries, from other places around the world, to be there to work because they don't mind those type of jobs. And regardless of the decision made, was the infrastructure of that work prepared? And the answer is no, obviously. And that's why I brought it up. But there's two other reasons, other things that I wanted to dive into is obviously there's a lot of humanity that spent a lot of time before work and after work, preparing for work. And I don't know how you phrase this or how you look at it. A lot of people who work Monday through Friday, they're saying, oh, I have the Mondays. It's a Monday. And there's this whole thing that they spend the entire weekend or even all their Sunday preparing for the Monday to go to work because they dread it. And some people, they've got to get rest and go out and exercise on those evenings or mornings or the weekends just to prepare to be mentally and physically ready to do a job, whatever their job is. And that, and then there's during, especially during this time, there's 86% job dissatisfaction around the world in what people do for work. And that's why a lot of them are spending so much time preparing before and after just to go to work. And so I want to hear from you. What are you seeing? What's the research? What have you discovered? Is this true? What? How do we fix that? How do we say, boy, I work 40 hours a week, but I also spend another 10 to 20 hours just preparing to go and back. So it's really 50 hours. And that's time that I could spend with my loved ones or working on myself to do what I want.
Yes, I guess there's top and bottom end to that, isn't there? Back to the how leaders and companies should view success and productivity, and absolutely employee well-being should be a central KPI, shouldn't it? The KPIs that are reported at the board table of sales, or if you're a tech company, engagement or whatever. I'm absolutely of the belief that employee well-being should be a core KPI. Because if you get that, all the others will work out. And putting aside any business of bad apples, wrong people in wrong jobs, you know, there's always going to be that. But as a general rule, I think some measure of KPI of well-being at a top level and accepting the findings of that, not just as, oh, we did well this month, or whatever our measure would be is up 2%, but actually, why, what do our staff need? So that's part one. I think that's important. And I do a lot of work with a fantastic company in the UK called Teacup, that I mentioned a few times in the book, who brought a lot of the learnings from sport and high performance, in the sense of if you're going to be a high-performing athlete, you need to think about your whole existence holistically. Is not just train, and we'll have there's plenty of books about this, you know, but now elite sports people also have to think obviously about diet and nutrition, but also about just relaxation and meditation or whatever it might be. It's a very holistic view. So they tried to bring some of that science through a project actually at the University of Bath, where I got to know them, into an absolute measure of that. But I think the interesting thing they do, and I'm not trying to sell them, I'm saying it's a principle. So you get the board, get the KPIs, but actually their approach is very individual to the, so you're not trying to, back to your point, it's not, the answer to making our staff happier isn't building a games room. The answer for Mark might be something very specific, and that's what it's trying to do. So I think acceptance of that's important. And then if you have organizations that accept that, it then gives the freedom for, it should give the freedom for individual employees to break that pattern you've talked about. I have a presenter 23-3 more, but the important bit is, and again, there's plenty of science to say, even a 20-minute walk without your tech in nature or being out in nature for 20 minutes. And when I take teams out, I do a very short, I don't do forest bathing, I call it forest dipping, just sitting out in nature for 5 minutes silently. There's these real short routes to the sort of default mind mode of your brain, and which just puts you in, one, in a good mood, which is always good, but it frames you to do much better at your job. So I think there are little things that individuals could do. And I was actually just this morning reading an article in the Guardian here in the UK by a great journalist called Joel Snape, who was lamenting the New Year's resolutions of people doing ice bucket challenges or whatever, deep things to reset their body. And he started with the premise that, I don't want to do those, they sound hard, I'm quite lazy, and did some research. And found out that actually one of the issues with, and I'm not trying to knock these things, one of the issues for going for a really taxing bicycle ride or running a triathlon or doing really the hard stuff that people try to cram into those short weekends because they're hard at work, they're great for your fitness and your body, don't get me wrong, but they're not actually that great for your brain. Yeah, you'll be better just to slow down and take an extra 20, 30 minutes walking to work with your phone off before you sit down at your desk. I think that would have much more benefits than probably anything else. But the employers need to allow people the time and freedom to do that and realize that it's beneficial. And I think the individual bit, for you, that might be doing it at 7 a.m. For someone else, it might be doing it at 9:30, 10 a.m. I worked a long time in education. You mentioned teaching. And education never changes. Yeah, policy and governments tend to really not change education over any length of time. Little things change. But there's loads of reports in education that school shouldn't start at 8 a.m. Plenty and plenty of science that that's really bad for kids' brains. Whack them into school, in the UK anyway, into school at 8, working at 8:30, doing maths questions. And then in the afternoon, you do some PE, some physical. There's plenty of science that says that should be entirely the other way around. And, yeah. and that's kids developing. We're still the same people as we were when we were kids. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there are simple things the individual can do. But I think what I'm really keen on is, and mine's only one way, walking in nature. But I think that acceptance, the employee well-being in its deepest sense, not just some gift vouchers and a fruit basket, has massive payoffs for companies.
I agree. In the discussing future of work anyway is a big topic for a lot of my colleagues and what I've done over the years. And you mentioned innovation and you mentioned key performance indicators, so KPIs. I think that one, innovation is basically futurism. It's about the future. It's about how do we do impact innovations for purpose. And it's a very transitional tool to get us there and involves a lot of creativity. But when we get into this key performance indicators, I tend to cringe a little bit because it's a past performance indicator. It's history, it's gone, and we can't predict the future based on history. It usually ends up repeating itself. And then in the same guise of KPIs, you also mentioned this high performance athletes. Most people will have 40 years at least of work, and to expect a high performance athlete for 40 years, 40 hours a week in an old infrastructure is a recipe for failure. We want people who are regenerative, that are around for a long time, and that also those businesses are around for a long time instead of just the annual reviews and the boards and did they meet those goals, and the goals always get higher and harder and you're constantly in this competition factor. I think if you're a high performance athlete, which most, whether it's Olympics or any other sport, those are short careers. Most of them start young and they're only 10 years long. It's very rare that you see, oh yeah, as football player for 40 years and was fabulous all along, never got traded. Whatever the athlete is, tennis players, something happens where they get an injury, they get old, someone younger who's worked their ass off, just replaces them. That's not a very bright future. It's not one of work, because which is sad, because work supports our life. It supports our family. It pays our insurance. It makes sure that we're healthy and happy. And so with that mindset of key performance indicators, and we need to perform like a key athlete, that means that we've got to do a lot of pre-work. And this is what I mentioned before we go to work and after, just to maintain that level of action. And I just wanted to make that comment based upon what you said, but it ties into the second point that I wanted to.
Can I just ask a question on that, Mark?
Sure, please.
I totally agree that I guess most athletes, elite athletes, are going to peak in their, like you say, teens and late teens, 20s, depending on the sport. But do you think is there a peak time for, let's say, creative innovators? Is there a peak time? Because it's probably not when you start out, is it? Is your peak performance 10 years if you've kicked into your career? Or I guess it's very variable, isn't it?
It's really variable. And so there's been numerous studies on that as well. Most of the studies that I read is the biggest innovators are almost towards retirement age. It's the Frank Lloyd Wrights, the Buckminster Fullers, the Fritz Hof Capras, the Lynn Margulises, the Carl Sagans, that's about the later, wiser years of their life that they start to do this. And there are many young innovators, the have spent a lot of time to do that, the Elon Musk, the Thomas Edisons, and that. But most of what we see is I hate to say it's not even golden years, but they're up there on
wisdom. I wonder if that is, obviously experience plays a part, but I wonder, back to your point about that future side, but absolutely, you don't get anywhere without imagined futures, and you find ways to generate what the future could be. Do you think is that experience which leads to that, or is it age freedom just leads to your ability to imagine the future better? I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with, in those younger years, we're just competing to catch up, to get up to speed with that collective intelligence that has been learned around the world. And whether it's the Elon Musks or the young innovators, even younger innovators of our time, the Boylan Slapes who do the ocean cleanup project, or I'm trying to think some of the other younger innovators. They spend a lot of time to just get up to speed. Others are also have a form of a genius factor in them as well. And so they're early adapters and pioneers of the thing. But they're Bertrand Piccard, Dr. Bertrand Piccard, the first man to fly around the world in the solar impulse airplane. He's not a young man, but he's an adventurous. Richard Branson started out in younger years, but he's also getting up there in years. And I think some of these stories is there's that understanding of the way the world works. And it's not just sheer wisdom, but it's that experience that the more we interact with nature, the more we have that symbiosis with nature and harmony with our natural world, and we imply those models into our life and into that, we realize it's a better model. It's not just a better model for life, it's a better model for business. Instead of being extractive and capitalistic, which all have a limit to growth. Yeah, there might be exorbitant amount of wealth or growth or GDP, but eventually there's a time where it just runs off and collapses and goes to an end. And in your book, you have a lot of wonderful examples. And this is to the third point that I wanted to bring up, is you have the former CEO of Patagonia, Lon Chindray here. I can't even never say his last name. Fabulous guy, spends a lot of time outside for many years, didn't even have a cell phone, does a lot of telephone conversations, but most of his time is outside thinking, climbing, walking. Then you have the Tim Cooks and Steve Jobs, and who this barefoot hippie, relaxed techie, and walking around a lot, but also create a working environment that is somehow tied to nature. There's a lot of walking. There are big, huge campuses where they walk around. They have different form of connection to, they're trying to bring the nature inside in some respects, but they're also building these huge campuses that they need to walk around and communicate and go to this department or that department to engage with their people. And that there's a lot of not just outside forest or outdoor nature walking, but there's a physical movement in the way they've structured their organization, that a good part of their day is spent in that local commute, that office or campus commute of how they do their work, which I think is really interesting. And I wanted to address that, because most of the successful people, even Tim Ferriss, I mentioned him earlier, the 4-hour work week, he spends a lot of time kind of walking and traveling around, focusing on health and being effective use of time. He spends a lot of time on podcasts and behind the computer as well, but it's a lot less than those walking meetings and those discussions. And the retention of his mind and the knowledge is a lot of that work occurs, and creativity, that innovation occurs through communication and retention in one's brain capacity, that then when they get behind the computer, or when they're cooking the meal, or when they're trying to produce the computers or do the production, that it's then exactly know what they need to do, and it's done, it gets done, and that actual work or productivity time is more effective. Whereas I'm in Germany. So if you look at a government worker in Germany, they probably spend not even 4 hours an entire week on actual work, and the rest of the time is just off drifting and going to the coffee machine and the water machine and not really actually doing the work because the whole setup is so confined. The way we work is so weird. This leads me to two things. So I'm also a techie. I also have one of my first degrees in computer science and I love technology. And I kind of sense that not only are you an educator, but you have this techno lust or techie kind of background, even though you said your degree was in archaeology, right? Am I correct? Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
I never went to work as an archaeologist. I worked out in the States actually in tech from sort of early 90s. So yes, absolutely it's there. And now dived back in to be co-founder of a new tech company. So yes, absolutely.
And the ties of the three things that you brought up where I mentioned Patagonia Outdoors and Steve Jobs and Boiling Slate Ocean Cleanup Project, a lot of big innovators and companies and front runners, they're doing a lot more planetary services, which are tied to the outdoors and cleaning up our environment and nature. They're doing a lot more regenerative agriculture, permaculture. They're doing a lot of companies that how can we make our built environment better, our world cleaner? And there is still that form of technology, but most technology and mechanization and heavy industry, we're trying to get into AI and to mechanization so that it's automated, which inherently would give us social distancing, would let robots take over menial jobs and tasks that humans shouldn't be doing anyway, can't do it as effective anyway, and give us something of more meaning and creativity for the future work. But the reason I bring up techie and educator, and you can dive more into that third question, but this really ties to it. So I am a big head of, if you believe something, you're an innovator, and that you also live and breathe it, or you find tips and tools and tricks, and you've included those in the book. But I want to go even further. So in your experience as an educator, you get to the classroom, and how is your classroom set up? Mostly in chairs and mostly a student sitting down, and sometimes even the professor sitting down where they probably should be standing, lecturing, showing slides, presentations, standing up and that. How do we see that environment change? And your techie background, how do we see that environment changing as well in the area of ergonomics? And this is so that we can bring that outdoors and that walking and a different form of doing business for the future that ties to the outdoors and walking and bring that into the future of work. And the statement for you to now address that is, we are in the Anthropocene of chairs. There are 6 to 8 chairs per person on this earth. That means minimum 60 billion chairs on our earth. We go from sleeping in the bed to standing up, sitting at the table to eat breakfast, maybe sitting in the shower or the bathtub to shower, sitting in the bus or car to go to work. Then we go to sit to get to work. Then we sit down to at our work and at our desk. We sit down to go to lunch, and it's taking lives off of our time out and life away from us as human beings on our health, on longevity of life, but it's also changing the future. We're becoming more sedentary in the way we do things. How do you think, as someone who believes the science and has done that, how can we change those environments so that in the future, you're not going to be saying, hey, we need to go outside and walk and do working meetings and team buildings outside, that we change the future of work to shorten it to those 4-day work weeks, to shorten it to those things, to have that more productivity and effectiveness in the way we do things. As you see, I'm standing now. I lecture a lot. I speak all over the world. And I've been standing for over 28 years. I have standing desks. Before that time, I used to turn a garbage can upside down and put my computer on top of it. And people looked at me like crazy. But sitting is the new smoking, our world, and we need to figure out ways to get back into just natural ways of a better lifestyle. Once you've answered that kind of, or talked to me about what your research and what you've discovered about that, I want to really, the next question, because I want to set it up because we're going into this journey of this work-life balance. And I want to have a little discussion about that, what your thoughts and studies and what you've researched and what you talk about in the book as well.
Okay. Firstly, I left at the uni last year to join ESWitch, and it'll join up in this, what I'm going to talk about now. So my last unit I was teaching at the University of Bath was to computer science, postgrads actually. And I was teaching a course on entrepreneurship. So basically the idea, if I was being cynical, the uni's idea was stay here, do more research, and maybe think about your own business. Don't go and work for Facebook. The idea was we did got them into groups and got them to take an idea and put it through the mill to see if, just conceptually, is there a business in here? What would I have to think about, etc. So it's a fun course. So I had 180 students signed up to that course. And to your point, I stood up in the front of a big lecture theatre with the slides on. So I stood up and walked around. I think out of 180, the most people who ever came into the lecture theatre now was about 35. Everyone else was sat in their student rooms streaming it. So it was live streamed and recorded. Ping, ping, everyone's watching it. Campus here, most of the student accommodation or a lot of it is on campus. So some of them were probably in their rooms 200 meters from where I was stood up delivering the lecture. So I found that very strange. So that's one thing. So that's a hard thing to break, isn't it? So they are sat, not only just sat, some of them in the lecture theatre who've made the effort to come, but some of them have literally just sidled out of bed and stuck their headphones on and sat there. So it's hard, isn't it, to know how that could change. And I suspect, obviously, the big driver of that was COVID, that everything suddenly was live streamed. But to take that a big leap forward, I'm not going to talk much about ESWitch, but the startup we're involved in is actually designed for good, to help people with things like motor neurone disease, ways of communicating and seeing with the world when they've lost all their muscle control, whether that's severe cerebral palsy, losing a muscle in their ear. So it started with great things, but the tech has moved on quite a lot. And one of the areas where the key areas for us is AR. So it's controlling things you're viewing in AR. Now, we don't make the tech. The tech's got a long way to go. But I like the concept of AR as a freeing thing. Now, putting aside the risk that it's taken over by behemoths of advertising, which will always be there. But if I'm being a bit altruistic, I can imagine a world where you can be out in nature with all the benefits of nature, of moving your body. And there's science, as you've read in the book, around optimal speeds. There's a specific speed of walking, which gets you in this default mode, which makes your neurons fire. You're not moving too fast. And there's great physiological history is our most efficient moving speed. And you link that to another great study book by Benjamin Baird called Inspired by Distraction, which was one of the first papers which took me on this journey, was our brains are at their most creative not when we're working, we're doing a really taxing task. So not I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna write this book, I'm gonna sit here and tap and read loads of stuff. And not when we're just relaxing, lying on the sofa. Our brains fire most in this little bit in the middle of a slight distraction, doing a slightly distracting task. And luckily, walking in nature and all that goes with it in terms of where your feet are going, the fractal patterns of what you're looking at, all instantly, it's a shortcut basically to get you in this state. I can foresee a world where that is work. You've got some smart glass on and you are having a conversation or you're partaking in something or you're learning something, but you are free to do that, whether you're walking through the city, through the park, whether you're up the Atlas Mountains in Morocco. So that would be my dream, that is, that technology allows that freedom, but gives universities or employers the confidence that those people are learning, participating, working. I think technology can help. Now, maybe that's a dream too far, but I do quite like AR as a concept. I think it's got a lot of, going back to where I started, that AR in terms of people with disabilities and assistive technology is a fantastic thing in terms of allowing. One of the inspirations for ESWitch was a young man called Jonathan Bryant, who's got severe cerebral palsy, can hardly move any parts of his body, can't talk. And he wrote a book when he was 13 called I Can Write, as in EYR, using his eye tracker. And the call for the book, as he said, was, I haven't got learning difficulties. He's a really clever guy. I don't have learning difficulties, I've got communication difficulties. And the education system is putting me into this learning difficulties. I've got no problem learning, I just can't communicate. I think AR, and you're starting to get, hopefully, the tech does excite me, especially when there's some good, but I also see it is place in the future of work, that it could have a place to allow people to not sit at their desk, to move around. And I think they personally, but also the organizations they work for, would see productivity, are all the things they want to see as a result of that, because combining those two things, or combining all those things, the fact of movement and what that does to your brain, fact of looking and being in nature rather than in some square rooms and walls, and doing something, not just totally relaxing, is a powerful set of tools together. Maybe proper deep tech in AR does have a place in the future of work.
I also really wanted to maybe thought what your ideas of more, how do we create the future of work and the ergonomics? I touched on the ergonomics as well. Up until recently, there's not a lot of schools that have the opportunity to stand, have a standing desk for students. We're in their education, whatever level of education, even higher learning, there's not a lot of opportunities for that, and we're boxing in the future of our things. And I wanted to tie that to this work-life balance. How can we talk about it? Can we offer these solutions that you have the science, you have some really good facts that the ROI is so much positive if we combine nature, walking, the outdoors, and our life experiences. But no matter what tool we found, is the world, is our country, our city, our state that we live in prepared for the future of work based on policy, infrastructure? Are those new companies, are there companies, new companies popping up around all over the place, like Apple or Boilant Slate, or these new office buildings that you see, these campuses for the future of work, to be ready to help people transition into that, to even to get there? Can we do, you know, in Germany, it's almost impossible to have a 4-hour work week, to be considered to have a permanent or a full-time contract. They have clauses in there. It says 38 hours, 36 hours, something like that, is the minimum to have a permanent full-time contract. And if you reduce that, you can't. Who came up with that stupid rule? So what I'm trying to say is policy, regulation, governance for businesses or infrastructure, how have we looked at that? And then how do we get that built environment of schools or the future of education, the future of technology to be conducive of that? Or are we just talking about these innovations or these great tools that have actually existed forever, but there's no way to put them into true practice because it's a fight or uphill battle? I'll give you one example that maybe can tie to that I had someone say, boy, I get so tired and I get neck pain by sitting at work and looking at this computer. This was probably 11 years ago. How can I get one of these standing desks? Back then they had these cardboard monkey desks that you could put on your desk and to raise it up to stand. And I says, boy, I'd like to have my workplace be a little more ergonomic and I'll feel better. And they started doing that at home and they knew it was effective. And they said, my work won't let me. They won't pay for it. They won't let me change the office furniture. I can't bring in. They said, I have to go to the doctor and get a physical therapy note that I need a standing desk in order to do it. And I think the world's gotten much better in that respect. But we come up with these practices and our work-life balance is totally out of place. We're living a separate life or at work or functioning much different at work than we actually would function at home. And so I want to know your thoughts and what your insights that you see in that direction as well.
Yeah, I'm not confident that policymakers will do much about it in this country anyway. I think it's got to be people's push, hasn't it? I think you need enough companies thinking differently, that best staff start to choose those companies and demand, and that's probably always the best way. So that we have to get enough innovative companies to embrace new ways of doing things. Eventually, hopefully, it becomes the norm, but at least it allows enough people to question other companies' ways of doing things. Hopefully, my book's a little bit of that. I'll tell a story. There's a fantastic company near me. They're quite a big tech agency, so they're not, you know, not an Apple, not huge, but they made the decision actually during lockdown. So they have an office, very traditional office. It's quite a nice office in that, you know, in the funky way. But they built about 20 minutes from their office in lockdown, they built a forest office. So they now have two site office, and the forest office is covered, so you are, but it's not heated, so you're outside, but they have fitted it with desks and Wi-Fi, so maybe there's a step for them to go, and they have veg beds and other stuff there. And so it was a response to COVID. How can we start to work together without going into the office and be socially distanced? But post it, all the feedback from staff and themselves is, this is the way we now want to work. So you have a choice. You go to the physical office, part of the day you want the 20-minute walk to the forest office and work there, or you want to take your meetings there. So they're definitely on that step of having been forced to experiment with something to realize that this works and the staff like it. I do see the shoots of it happening in some companies. I guess I'm more cynical. Perhaps I'm more cynical about the big companies, the campus approach. You know, there's a massive new Google building being built in right in the center of London at King's Cross on campus. And I've been in the building next door and looked down on it, and it's a sort of skyscraper on its side, and you can see they are building green spaces into it, but I suspect it is basically still be a workhouse inside, really. Yeah, I'm more cynical of big companies. I think innovation does tend to come from smaller companies. So I'm seeing the shoots of that, which I think is quite interesting. To the work-life balance bit, I think that's back to where I started. I think it's that acceptance that they're almost part of the same, as such, whether we're a 4-hour or 36-hour, back to your hunter-gatherer, work life was the same thing. Yeah, my work was my life was my work, it was all outdoors, and I know we're not going to get back to that. But the sort of concept that it's wrong to go and sit in a box for 8 hours, shut the door, and then my life begins. And I think that's been a problem for a very long time. So I don't know what the answer is, Mark. I think you need more smaller innovative companies just trying different things. But I think people have to push it, really. And I see people are starting to push it in their own ways, employees. But we also have to be aware that I have this conversation quite often about the work I do. And which is why I try to make it accessible, because there is lots of jobs where it is just really hard to do that. All the NHS frontline staff in the UK, they're not going to get their 20-minute walk, probably. So what's the answer for a lot of those jobs? I don't know. I think you could take a long view where, you know, you have more staff and you allow them to work more flexible time and shorter hours so they can regenerate and replenish themselves, but I suspect their actual time at work is still going to be pretty intense. Although I guess a lot of them aren't sat at a desk in a chair staring at a screen.
In Germany they have this thing, it's like a prevention health thing for all employers, that there's, I think it's 40 hours a year and a certain amount of 500 euros. It's probably even gone up to 1500 euros a year now, and monies for prevention to improve your health at work, or has to do with ergonomics and training and outdoors and making sure that you're preventing any future issues. And part of that is this just health and outdoor bathing and out being getting outside and better breaks and better work structure. But I see so many tools throughout your book that you give on thinking outside and your 23-3 rule. And you talk about the stories and the factor of that. What is your hope, dream, and desire for those who read the book? Is it just to, I'm not even going to say it. What is your true hope and dream desire of those who read the book to take away and be able to do that? I know you do your own walks and you also do team building and things as well, which is super for creativity, innovation, and that as well. But can you give us your own surmise of what your takeaway is for everybody?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. So for individuals, I think I've hopefully honed it in that 23-3 rule, which is, let's just make it really simple about spending time in nature. Do the methodology if you like, but I think if you just, and I've adopted this now for a long time, and you know it really works, is, you know, if you can spend, and let's say I'm Michael Easter was actually from an idea of theirs. I've tweaked it a bit, but 20 minutes a day outside in nature, ideally walking without your phone. 3 hours every couple of weeks on a proper, let's call it a hike, I think that'd be ideal, but given people's just, again, out in nature. And the really powerful one, and all the science racks up, is once a quarter, go somewhere for 3 days where you're going to spend almost all of that in nature, because the what that does to your brain increases exponentially in day three. You read this as a great experiment that happened in the States with Ruth Atchley, where, you know, the levels of creativity, and you can take that as a proxy for lots of things, but it's getting your brain in a really nice default state. The creativity is a measure of that, rise incredibly on that third day. So I hope for individuals, regardless of who they work for, that is just a good equivalent of your 5 a day vegetables, just something you can build into your life, and you will feel better. You will have more ideas if you want more ideas, and you will have more clarity of thinking by doing that. If you want to do the methodology, and this is, I guess, the business bit, is I think it is, I've spent years being forced, let's call it forced, I always questioned it, to use the business canvas. And you're sitting in a dull room trying to work with an early stage company about their strategy and innovation, and it's awful. So I think for businesses, my call is don't book that meeting room in a soulless hotel thinking you're going to have some blue sky thinking and fantastic new ideas. Just don't do it anymore. It does not work. Take that outside, whether that's with a facilitator like me, whether that's on your own. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying you don't end up writing some things on a flip chart or capturing some stuff, but that's my call to the business. Just don't do that anymore. That we've got to do an away day next quarter, and this is our agenda in terms of most people's agendas on those is future looking. They tend to think, oh, those strategies we're going to think about the next year. Just don't do that. Take that outside. So those are my two ends. Businesses, stop that behavior of booking some horrible course or training room. And for individuals, just spend more time in nature without your tech, and you will properly see the benefits. And hopefully there's a middle ground where those come together and affect some future of work change.
Before we get off this work-life balance, I want to get your inputs or your feelings as well. I ask people a lot of the time, what are the models that they're operating in a typical day of their life? So is it a very capitalistic or an extractive model? Are they part of a religion or a culture? Do they have a family life and a work life? And what are all the different models that they live in a typical day? And it's usually more than three models every single day in their life. But at the very least, it's two. It's usually this work model. It's what they do at work and who they are at work. And it's what they would like their life at home to be. And those two models, or those two work and life, are usually going in different directions. And it's also a way for you humanity to be disconnected from nature, but it's also a way of almost feeling this bipolarness that we're two different people in the same day. We're going in two different directions. We're just doing the job because we need it to pay the bills, and we need it to give us the lifestyle and healthcare and the food that we need on the table. But when we're at home, we don't want to see any work colleagues. We just want to spend time with our family or drinking a beer, watching soccer, or whatever we do. Maybe we're an athlete, maybe we do sports, maybe we do go out into nature, but when we are, we're not thinking much about our work because we want to forget about it. We want to have it be a 9-to-5 job or a position that we don't have to put a lot of thought into it after. But that creates this inner turmoil in humans that, you know, we've heard about it for decades. I'm sure you have, this work-life balance. And that's why I bring it up, because when we get behind the science of it, when we get behind the realities of it, are we living a psychotic life? Are we living a bipolar life where we're trying to please two masters at once just because that's what we need to survive? And how can we, instead of this work-life balance, how can we create a lifestyle that even if we work for a tech company, even if we work for a production company that requires us to stand on an assembly line for 8 hours a day or 7 hours a day, that we can still have this lifestyle that we've created of joy and happiness. We feel connected to nature and that. And I think those are the tools that I would like to know how you feel about it, but how can we apply what we're getting from this book besides the 23-3 rule to really bring that into a new paradigm of how we create that lifestyle of the future, of the innovation aspect that we talked about earlier, that how do we reach that true future? Because I think that's eventually where we want to be. I don't want to make your writings or your life obsolete, but I would like us to not say, hey, are you connected to nature? Are you doing environmental social governance? Are you doing sustainability? I would like that to be the way the world works in the future. I would like, instead of talking about the future of work, we actually create a different paradigm of the way the world works in the future that is connected to nature, is connected to environment. We realize that big organism that we see outside, the organism of life and nature, that is the best model for our organizational structures and our organizational models that we see at work. And I'd love to hear your thoughts and reflections and maybe tips that you can give us.
Gosh. There's a lot there, isn't there?
I make it simple. Yeah, it'll always be a lot. It'll be complexity in systems, but I want to hear it.
I'm sure, just reflecting personally, I'm sure I'm like, as you started that, like most people, I have a lot of people. I have a family life. I have kids and older relatives, and I have a number of jobs, which I think suits some people, doesn't suit other people. I often say I'm a natural tinker. It suits me to have four different jobs as opposed to one, and maybe that's a good reflection for a lot of people. Maybe that is a way to think about your work and life differently. Is maybe there's a time coming when there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, about people not having one career but having four in their lives now. Maybe, I guess it's been driven by people living longer, I think. And there's another way to view it, that actually you change, your brain changes, and maybe you should embrace that. And it's always, all these discussions are always partly parking economic priorities, aren't they? But as you said, you do need to earn money to pay bills. Yeah, I think very personally, I've always given myself the freedom to be curious in terms of work and allow that to take multiple forms and not that stress me. But definitely for me, there's no doubt that just nature and the outdoors is the medicine for that. And there's a movement here in the UK for social, I'm sure it's not just the UK, social prescriptions. And walking is now one of those. So there's a trial actually in my local area of doctors prescribing walking for people. But it's missing the point, isn't it? Because then whenever you prescribe something, it's because you've gone too far down some problem of health. So it's back to the same point, I think, is that your nature is a really powerful thing to have in your life for all sorts of purposes. So that's always my first call, and whatever form that takes. I talk in the book about my time as an archaeologist, and there's lots in archaeology in terms of academic thought, etc. But actually, working outdoors, it's a bit like being a farmer. And there's a lot to be said for that, and that's probably why your brain works well in interpreting what you're doing. To a bigger side of that, I think, it's interesting, isn't it, that you think about the big policy things happening in the world in terms of the meetings like COP. We had COP Glasgow a while back here. And supposedly all of the movers and shakers in thinking about the environment and on a global scale basically took over every hotel room in Glasgow, didn't they? And I know
that was crazy.
Flew in their private jets. And to my very small point of a company saying, don't book a ballroom, go and do something which connects you with nature because you'll get a lot more out of it. That just seems madness to me. that's the way that thinking is trying to happen. I don't know if that answers your question in any way.
Yeah, same way. I was at COP26 in Glasgow, and I actually stayed a little bit, about an hour and a half, or maybe even more. I was about 2 hours away from Glasgow and had to drive every day to get into the COP. But it is sheer madness. And I just came from COP27 in November from Egypt in Sharm el Sheikh, and it's sheer insanity what occurs there. And has very little to do with outdoors or the nature, although we're talking about nature and environment, how we protect it and do it. It's that there's always this thing that brings us back to the time behind the desk, the time behind the computer, the part that how do we do those negotiations? How do we write the proposals or do the things that are necessary to fulfill the mission or to fulfill the order to do the job that we need to do? And those can't always be done in nature. But I believe that connection to nature or to being outside gets you into the thinking that the origins of everything, of products, food, resources, the environment that we're talking, all starts outside in nature. That's where the resources come to build the computers that we're talking on, to build the internet, the fiber optic lines or the satellites. They're all created from resources outside, and they're mainly the wiring and cables are outside, buried or above ground, one way or the other. And to disconnect ourselves from food or nature or the way the world really works or those models is a big mistake. And that's why organizations have that limit to growth or that collapse factor or disruptive factor, is because they lose sight of their supply chain and how those long processes work, but also that our infrastructures around the world are out of date and keeping up to speed with our exponentially growing world and how the world really works. And that's why earlier I mentioned, how can we get those policies in line that we can still do work, we can still have a job, and we can still be productive, but how do we combine it more with nature? How do we make sure those policies and those things are in place that when we innovate and say, boy, you know what? Working just 4 hours a week is a hell of a lot more productive than 40 hours a week. And here's why. But then we come up with this idea and the science behind it. And then the policy of your government or where you live or the infrastructure is not, it's not, broadband's not a human right for you to be able to work outside in nature, or the employment laws are not set up to be able to do that. So no matter how great we find the science or that, the infrastructure and the policy and governance of that system is not ready for that transition. And so it forces us back into almost the definition of insanity of how we're doing, how we're living as human beings. I just think it's so crazy that we can trade our work from life, that those aren't one thing, and they have been one thing for many decades and eons. And it's just since the Industrial Revolution where it's really changed, the last 200, 220 years, changed into that, a really separation of reality from where we should be. And it's affecting a lot of our health, our healthcare, and systems like that. I love your book and the science and what you talk about, the tools and this connection and what aha moments and what innovations and creativity emerge by doing the practices you talk about. I believe it's greater tools, and by no means to force you in any ways to go beyond what you created this beautiful work or in your examples and the journeys that you take us on in the book. But I'm always trying to push the boundaries. How can I get great thought leaders like you and the people you write about in the book to think about how do we really get that transition? How do we make that connection to the future our world needs to go into? And then automatically that environmentalism, that when we're connected to nature and the outdoors, I don't think you're out there on your walks and your hikes out there throwing your plastic trash everywhere. Hopefully you're leaving the world better than you found it, the nature better than you found it. And you're saying, hey, we need to protect and preserve it. And when I do work, go back to work, I'm going to realize, boy, how much energy and stuff I really got out of being in nature. And I want to preserve that. I want to restore it and regenerate it. And I think that affects also how you are when you're at work. And that's the reasons I bring that up. Do you have anything to say about that?
I'm sort of thinking about an experiment now. The thought you articulated, the sort of 4-hour work week, 4 hours of productive work, spending the rest milling around coffee machines and chatting. I wonder if was brave enough to accept that's all you get. If you let someone free them from the shackles of that office and let them be in nature, do what they want, would you get 8 hours productive work?
I think you'd get a lot more, to tell you the truth.
Is that actually more productive if you really break all those shackles? And I guess there's companies which are embracing post-COVID the work from anywhere. But you don't.
That's also a big infrastructure when you think about it, that the post-COVID or even COVID time, they're embracing it. But is it up to speed? I heard stories, people were getting ergonomic issues by working from their kitchen table or their bed or their sofa, that they were starting problems. And then companies started to ship computers and better routers so that they could do work from home and chairs to the home. But then people were like all over the world were saying, we don't have broadband as a human right. I don't have enough broadband for my kids and my wife and myself to work from home. I don't have enough rooms, computers.
It's freezing cold.
Yeah, exactly. So there's so many things you hear in entrepreneurship and serial entrepreneurs and startups always hear about beach money or this digital nomad, go work from the beach and go work from anywhere in the world and that. And it is possible, but there's also a reality factor of the infrastructure of where and how that work looks like. Most of those people aren't producing food or farming or building computers or writing code for software or whatever there is. Those people are creating social media content or writing books or doing different things where that type of a lifestyle is conducive.
Generally not managing a family at the same time.
Exactly. They're not traveling around with a bunch of kids and a wife and a dog and living on the beach 1 week and the next in the forest. It's reality set in, but what are those realities of the future? The hardest question I have for you today, I'm going to drop it on you now, if that's okay, unless you wanted to talk a little bit more about my musings of how do we prepare the future. It ties to that. I want to ask you the burning question, WTF, which is what's the futures, but I want to twist it in a little bit of a different way. What does a world that works for everyone look like to you?
Gosh,
easy one, isn't it?
What does a world that looks like to everyone work for
what
everyone?
What does a world that works for everyone look like for you?
How utopian can I go? All right.
It's up to you. That's the thing. It's not what your job, your family. It's up to you. What does that look like?
I like globalization and I love the European project. I think open borders is a great thing for humanity. And this is parking whatever economic issues, but that would absolutely be there for me. We should be able to go wherever we want to go and work wherever we want to work. So that would be my utopian bit of my utopian future. We are, as we talked earlier, we were born out in nature and part of nature. So accepting that from that work-life side of things, and maybe it is that sense of allowing people, so not everyone can work wherever they want, but I'm opening the borders so people may be able to choose that, but maybe they should be allowed much more to work however they want. And yes, there'll be constraints of people's personal lives and families and whatever else they're dealing with. That 9 to 5 40 hour Monday to Friday is what's wrong. I think your point of going back to, even if you go back to the point of the agriculture revolution, people were suddenly more sedentary and working, but they still had a rhythm to their life, which was driven by nature, was driven by what they were growing, what they were nurturing, what they were planting, feeding their families. It wasn't, we go out in the fields and do the same thing every day. And I think that would be what I'd like to see work change to and businesses change to, And the one of the easiest ways to start to explore that is to embrace natural systems and regenerative systems, because you'll start to realize that works. And you'll start to realize that most businesses do, to some degree, follow that, even if they try to inflict the same thing every week. And I'm worked in young tech, really not a fan of the Wednesday stand-up, or the, I'm not against meetings at all, but it's that absolute rigid, this is what we do at the same time every day or week. Just
agile scrum, the meetings, the
just seems nuts to me. So maybe those two things: open all the borders and allow work to be much more of a natural thing as opposed to a constrained thing. I don't know how we do that, Mark.
When I said earlier, I really do think food and agriculture and animal agriculture domesticated us. It wasn't the other way around that we domesticated it. I think it really made it so that we had to say, stay put and do the harvests and do the planning and do the things, and much more became much more the beginnings of this sedentary type of a lifestyle. And the type of farming we did really also has created a ripple effect. But I love your why, and I'm also in alignment with that. I've only gotten that answer to the question, what does a world that works for everyone look like? Is open things up without nations and borders and this division of humanity one from another to go around. The thing I would like to ask is that the question to what you said is, it kind of says, not everybody can work anywhere. Why is that? What job would require, or what job is it that somebody couldn't work anywhere? I think that any job that you mention, no matter how shitty we think it is, or how bad of a job it is, or how, if it's screwing on a screw on a conveyor belt for 8 hours a day, just the same repetitive thing, however boring, or the boardroom, you have that section in your book about the boardroom, like the boring company, it's a boring type of a situation most of the time. That can be done anywhere in the world. And the interesting thing is, before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, local economies, local practices and production and manufacturing were the key. There was a lot more smallhold farmers and producers and manufacturers on a small scale, leather goods, food products, whatever you could think of, that build these little local economies. And they disappeared to the big cities. They disappeared to big industrial areas. And now those people who, the younger generations that we also talked about in our call, they left their small town cities and that to go where bigger opportunities are, right? And when they did, all those local manufacturing production left as well. And so now a lot of people get the imports from other places, the large areas. And actually, you could take your bakery, your leather production, whatever you want to do or produce or manufacturing, to pretty much any area or island of this world, and just start your own business or start your own local economy to contribute to other beautiful locations of the world, Bali and Fiji, or your dream is Alaska, Iceland, Greenland, who knows?
Yeah, that's the dream.
And then you've created a lifestyle. You're creating your own economy and saying, yeah, not only am I making and producing and doing this somewhere else, that may, I'm always wondering the big migration we've seen over the decades, where there's some people from beautiful places of the world that are coming to cold Germany or to cold places of Europe. They live in what I would consider a paradise, but they're leaving because the social infrastructure, the healthcare, the pay is not as good, but they just left that paradise to work for the almighty dollar. Why couldn't they create their own economy, their own production, what they want there in a flourishing lifestyle connected to that nature where they are? Because usually after they've made that almighty buck or that wisdom creeps in, they tend to want to return back to that home spot anywhere, that beautiful place that they were at. I'm a huge fan of Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, and he had a huge writer's block in his life. And it was run, he was writing the adventures of Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, and he just had this writer's block. He couldn't do it. And I'm in Hamburg, Germany. and have lived in Germany for a long time. My mother was German in that. And I heard the story because I went to Heidelberg University as a graduate there, that Samuel Clemens was there with his priest or preacher doing his tour to raise money because he had money problems a lot. So he would lecture and talk and do things as well. So he was in Heidelberg. And during the day, he and his priest friend, they would row up and down the river there in Heidelberg and visit the different castles up and along the river. And that activity of rowing and going up and walking through the nature into these castles and what in Germany they call burgs or big fortresses and things that they have a lot of in Europe broke that writer's block that he had. And when he writes about the Mississippi and being on the river and that, and the big steamboat captain, it was triggered by this creativity of being in Germany, total different language, beer, food, and they experienced that time in a total different place than the Mississippi River. As well, then he writes there's many reports in his autobiography, and that it was actually Germany that in a different location that broke that writer's block. And that we've talked about globalization and nature and this connectivity. It's just some creative things that you would say, wow, that how in the hell did that happen? You know, total different place, the best American novelist you'd ever see in stories. Most successful, and it was all solved in a total different country, total different language, looking at castles on I believe it's the Neckar or the Rhine River. I can't even remember what rivers they are that he rode up and down. It's unbelievable. But you also have that experience in the stories in your book as well on similar things with Legos and other things. I'd like to You've reached into this creativity aspect as well.
Absolutely. And I didn't put Mark Twain in the book, but actually I did read about him a bit in researching it. And he's not alone. There's a fantastic, another book by Frederick Gross called The Philosophy of Walking, which delves into a lot of thinkers and writers. And I talk about Nietzsche quite a lot in the book, who had very similar experiences, whether they were blocked or whether it was just when they were engaging in nature and walking and doing other things outside where their finest work came from. So, I think that speaks to that deep evolutionary physiological bit that no doubt things spark in your brain and connections are made and new ideas happen in that happy mix of walking's a way to do it, but being in nature and being slightly distracted and doing something not too taxing, but not totally relaxing, is a magic place from a scientific point of view. So I think I can totally understand why that happened. So I delve into some of those stories and my not so profound stories of walks I've done and that have had a profound effect on me. And there's a couple in the book. Some of them are to do with challenge, some of them to do with sensory perception. I tell the story of one where I couldn't see more than about 10 meters all day in the Welsh mountains. And it was like being in a sensory deprivation tank, and it was an amazing experience. I'm quite a fan of mixing the outdoors with sometimes challenge, but I think what's more important is new places. And there's a real powerful thing about being a different culture. So I lead a lot of trips and I take a lot of people to Morocco simply because I think there's another bit about being out of your cultural zone. So I find that interesting, but it can be as simple as getting lost, going somewhere totally new. I've got a great friend in Norway, Toril, in the book, who purposely gets lost. And talks about the benefits of that, and your sort of inbuilt GPS is suddenly clicking like crazy, and that's part of that. Neurologist Shane O'Mara talks about it's just a luck of evolution that the same bit of our brains that are to do with imagination are also our internal GPS, just the same neurons firing when you're trying to navigate somewhere new that also are a key to imagination. So there's a lot in there. But I think what that also leads me, and I talk quite a lot in the book, is that I think there's a myth that creativity is just thinking. And yes, it's almost the opposite, I think, that doing these things, your thoughts happen, but despite you, it's not sitting down to think. But actually, creativity is much more powerful if it involves acts of play, of making art, whatever that might form, that might take, that adds to it. I have a number of techniques I do with teams and that play on that. And the one that really works well, and I can show you some amazing videos from this from teams I've been with, where I, on the first part of the walk, I get them all to just find an item. I don't give them any rules. They just have to find a natural item on their walk. So you end up with leaves and twigs and moss and all sorts and flowers. And then at some point in the walk, I get them into teams and they have to, it depends on what the performance, but let's say you have to tell a story about someone on your team or your company using these items. And it's one of the things which gets the best, makes for good videos, because normally some of them, someone in there is quite amusing and does something amusing, but actually some quite deep insights come out of that. And I think that's something to do with things happening, but through a different sort of medium. And the classic one, which again, I quote in the book, is Lego. And I say that I think the best innovators are conceptually people who never stopped playing Lego with their friends. Doesn't mean they have to be doing Lego now, but it's that concept of sitting down with something without an idea of what the outcome's going to be with other people is a really powerful way to think about creativity. But you can use twigs and leaves and doesn't matter, rocks.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. I was in Copenhagen on this youth island, and we had a bunch of twigs, moss, leaves, flowers, and we had to build this ecological city of the future just out of the materials presented. And the amazing creativity and the things that people come up with. We were having these plants create energy and stuff, and just these processes that could thrive out of that is just it's astounding. I only have two more questions for you, and then we're done. I really appreciate you diving deep into not only just thinking outdoors and creativity and touching on parts of your book. The intent of our discussion was never to read or give away the entire book. We want to encourage people to go out there and read it and see how it applies to their lives. And if they also have the aha moments that I did, which led to maybe totally different questions that you hadn't thought before or heard before on how can we get to those futures? Because I'm totally with you on the outdoors and thinking outdoors. And I'm an environmentalist and I love walking in nature and encapsulating and building those things into my daily life and routine, creating a lifestyle out of that. Instead of me conforming, which I'm not a big conformist, into a lifestyle to be a robot or mechanic or work in some kind of environment that I wouldn't enjoy. And I would encourage and empower others to do that same factor. And that leads me to the last two questions. So I really appreciate that. If there was one message or maybe even two messages that you could depart to my listeners as a sustainable takeaway that has the power to change their lives, what would it be? What's your message?
Well, could I come up with something pithy now? I have used this one before. It sounds a bit jokey, but I think there's something in it, which is that bunking off is the deepest work you can do.
Okay, now I'm not from the United Kingdom. Bunking off, you got to explain towards me.
Oh, bunking off at working.
Just
deepest work you can do.
Drifting or just you're bunking off. Okay, that's a good one. I hadn't heard that one before. I love it. I think that's true. When you get out of your head or what the moment is, that's when these moments of creativity really come. I love that. That's a fabulous piece of advice. What have you experienced or learned in your professional journey so far, anthropology to technology to professor to entrepreneurship, that you would have loved to know from the start? You've had quite the journey. You're still on it. What would you have liked to start?
What would I have liked to have known from the start? I sometimes ask, it's not my question, but with walking, I ask people sometimes if they want to meet their 18-year-old self or their 80-year-old self. It's a related sort of question, isn't it? What would I want to name for my professional life from the start? So I'm gonna take a while to answer this. You'll have to edit this, Mark.
I ask this to a lot of people, and most people say nothing because I really like the journey. The journey has taught me a lot. Yeah. The other thing that I hear a lot in the way I answer this is, I wish I would have learned it sooner. I wish I would have started sooner. If I would have known all this, what I know now, I would have started much sooner. But this journey has been a development of discovery and learning things. Right. Some people wouldn't change anything. Those just maybe spark how you would answer that question.
Yeah, definitely. I've enjoyed the whole journey, and it is easy to think that I wish I would have been doing what I'm doing now earlier, but I probably couldn't have. It's all cumulative and Lego bricks. Yeah, my building now is a part of all of those. Not that I did this much. I struck out self-employed in my late 20s, so I didn't work for the man, if you like, for much of my life. What would I have done? Maybe some of those, especially that's bits before and maybe things since. I think I could have even been braver. And if it's not working for you, whether that's the company, the job, whatever, get out sooner. There's always something else you can do. So, and I think to your point you mentioned earlier, that's thinking the trap is my pay packet or my, and those things are important. But yeah, there's a times where I could have been braver and said, this isn't working, just walk out the door. It's not going to be the end. And maybe that would have led me somewhere different. But no, I think, the journeys, wish I had more time. I have dreams, like everyone has dreams. I'd have quite liked to have been a professor of archaeology and just done that my whole life, but I probably wouldn't have when it came to the reality of doing it day in, day, month in, month out.
Yeah, that I can see that as well. A lot of my younger life, I spent tons of time outside. I think it's not an easy transition. I told you that I've been standing for over 28 years now, but I had it easy. I did a lot of farming and I had a lot of family businesses that were outside and things that I did that were involved in that. So the transition was a lot easier, but I know other people that I've seen in working situations there start with health problems, headaches, or whatever it is. And to make that transition, it's not something that happens from one moment to the next. Everybody's different and takes time to make that transition. And so I know some people that made it from sitting to standing in 3 weeks, and others made it in a week, and others made it in a year. So it's where they kind of have to train themselves. It's just everybody's different, but change is good. If it wasn't, we would still be wearing the stinky diapers that we were right after our birth. It would be a shitty outlook, but change is a positive thing, and we all have that power to do that. We should be empowered to create our own local futures however we want it. The quicker we realize that, I think that we unlock the things that you talk about in your book. So Gary, I really appreciate you sharing the creativity factor with me and speaking to you. Thank you for sharing and letting us all inside of your ideas. Wow. And I've pushed the boundaries with you. So I've really tried to get your ideas to come out. So I love that you've says, I think this and I would do this and my personal experience. Because that's what I want to hear. I want to hear about the journey that you made so far. And I thank you for letting us all inside of your ideas. It's been a sheer pleasure. And that's all I have, unless you have anything else to add.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure, Mark. And everyone's different in all their ways of working and thinking. When I put that to my book, there also is an audio book where, it's not me speaking. It's a nice professional voice actor. Apparently, he's got a very soothing voice. It's good to take on a walk, maybe. Just a question for you then, Mark, because I've asked. I did a survey in my book of asking people, where do you have your best ideas, if you had to answer it?
My best ideas are always outside, absolutely. And I'm more of a mountain person, so I like mountains and forests as well. But I really, it's not talking above 3,000 meters, but I'm talking above 2,000. So I like that too. That's the top of the world feeling.
Very much me as well. Although, some people can't get out, they'll find it intimidating. But yes, I'm always drawn to mountains.
Other thing,
lots of mountain adventures this year to come.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope you have tons of them. I really also like working on the farm. I like getting my hands dirty and soil underneath my fingertips and being grounded to growing food. I think that growing food is like printing your own money. And a good friend of mine, the gangster gardener, Ron Finley, said that. And I just think it's so true. If we create our own things and do the toils of our own hands, we can create our own economies and really have beautiful futures. It's been a sheer pleasure. Thank you so much, Gary. Have a wonderful day, and I'm excited to release this podcast.
Thanks, Mark.